sorry.
I'm out of business and interview you at the same time. So, I accepted the deal with my in-laws and Air Products and started there in the fall of 52. Had sales of, as I said, about $2.5 million in that year. And I've spent the last 40 years there. One of the things I kid people about, I said that Pavlos negotiated such a tough deal that I've been really making it up ever since. One of the interesting things in those aptitude tests that they described was they said, well, what would you like to do at Air Products? What would your career ambitions be? And they had like seven lines on the chart and on a page. So I said, oh, well, I'd like to be a sales engineer. I'd like to become a sales manager, and I'd like to become vice president of sales. And then a general manager, and then a executive vice president, and then president and the chairman of the board. And I filled out all the seven lines. And that's precisely
really
what I did with my career. And so when young recruits come to Air Products, either right out of college or as summer interns, I tell the story. And I say, now remember, when you fill out an application form for Air Products, make sure you fill up all the lines. But it does make a point, I think, that I think that you can do anything you want to do, you know, assuming that the opportunities exist, that the climate exists. But and so if you want to become chairman and you do all of the things that if necessary, there's a possibility that you can be chairman and CEO of a company someday. But you just have to set goals and you have to set targets for yourself and then do all the things that are necessary. But I think so many people never set those goals. And the goals don't have to be expansive. They don't have to be complicated. When I went to England after I'd been with the company, the Stott Air Products in Europe, I put a strategic plan on one side of one piece of paper. I wanted 25% of the UK market, and I wanted 10% of the continental European market, and I wanted to do that within 10 years. When I became CEO of Air Products, I wrote the annual report for the year 1996, and we were then $2 billion in sales, and I said, by 1996, we're going to be $6 billion in sales, we're going to have earnings of $5 a share, we're going to have 50% of our sales outside the United States, we're going to have an environmental business, we're going to have a chemical business, we're going to have a gas business, we're going to be the leading industrial gas company in the world. Well, we are well on that goal, and partly, I think, as a compliment to myself, but the CEO who gave the speech at the annual meeting yesterday, Hap Wagner, my successor, says, we are right on our plan. And so it says that you can, if you set stretching goals, become better than you otherwise would without the goals. If you just respond to events rather than drive yourself towards lofty goals and then share those goals and get buy-in to those goals by everybody in the organization, people really like to respond to clearly defined challenges and not so precise and so restrictive that they don't have room to maneuver in operating. The great thing about my relationships with Ed Donnelly, and I don't know whether it was deliberate or it was just his style, but he gave me the latitude to develop the business as I thought it could be developed. And he would provide guidance and act as a referral source and somebody that you could bounce ideas off of it. But, you set the goals, you set the targets, you organize, and as long as you achieve those things. Now, goals can be unrealistic. so that nobody will buy into them because they don't believe in it. But I tell you, when we said we're going to be 3 times our size in 10 years, there are a lot of skeptics at Air Products too. But everybody has to feel that they're part of something that potentially can become bigger and better, and that they will be rewarded as a consequence. I mean, it's the driving forces that cause people to excel. So I filled out that application form and I hit every target, and it took me 40 years to do it. So it's just been a wonderful, wonderful experience.
Did you meet Leonard Poole before you signed on?
I met him just briefly in the hall, and his brother George, and you know, we were in a building smaller than this house. I mean, this is a 7,000 square foot house, so I don't think our office was that big. And we had a dirt floor factory out in the back. I met him, and you know, you're a young PFC out of the Army, and here's a guy that founded the company. He was a strong, clear focus, clear thinking, futures oriented kind of a guy, and I'm a young potential sales engineer, so it's hard to make quick impressions, but everybody has spoke well of Leonard, of his entrepreneurial spirit and his drive. But I think it was Ed who influenced me the most. I mean, Pavlis will take credit for hiring me, and is a guy going to hit a ball right out of the water? I want to see how much he gets splashed. I don't know why he didn't pick it up. Oh, he did pick it up. Ed was really my mentor for the first 5 years until I was asked to go to Europe. I became head of the sales of auction plants to the chemical industry. That was the area that I carved out as my niche. And then we had another sales manager who looked after government, somebody else looked after the steel industry, and those were the three major markets. And then we had a kind of an export business that was a fourth area. I operated in the export business to start with because it was the small package plants. And then the chemical industry started showing interest in air separation plants for a variety of ammonia plants and applications. And then I succeeded Ed as sales manager for all of the process equipment when he became general manager of the process, and then he had engineering and purchasing and design and manufacturing all reporting to him, and then I had the sales function, and I was still only maybe 29 years old.
It's a lot of responsibility for
I didn't think about it as it was a job that had to be done. It was fun doing it. There were lots of opportunities. We were building, relationships. We were very, very small. I mean, you don't, by any rights, we should never have existed. I mean, Union Carbide ignored us to their cars. But, I mean, they were king of the hill. I mean, they were 100 times our size. And they were the leader in this field, just as Linde was the leader in Germany, and British Oxygen the leader in Britain, and Leroy the leader in France, and Union Carbide, and they were in a club. I mean, they didn't compete with each other. This was a cartel. Four firms dominated the world markets for industrial gases, equipment, technology. They cross-licensed each other. It was absolutely incestuous club. and there were a few other distributors and producers, Air Reduction, at which had been the Leroy company in the United States, was a gas company, and So we would sell to other gas companies equipment, but we would have to compete with Linde and Lacroix, and Messer was a French, another German company. And so I decided that because I was an engineer, I really ought to understand the business side better, and finance and marketing. And so I signed up to get my MBA school degree at Lehigh. And I couldn't go full-time because I had a family and everything. But Air Products did have an education extension program. We've kept that up, and it's really worked very well. And so I took my MBA degree at night at Lehigh, and it took me about 4.5 years to do that. And one of the things that they required was a thesis on a major business project. And so I said, gee whiz, Air Products is 85% dependent on the federal government, because we were selling plants for the rocket program and package oxygen plants for the breathing and aviation, both Navy and the Air Force, and we had some business to the steel industry, but federal government. And the problem with that is, you know, it's up and down. They want something this year, but they don't want anything next year. And the company had gone through that cycle after World War II. And so I said, well, what we really ought to do is create a third leg, which is the international market. And so I did my thesis on the establishment of an international division for Air Products as a good idea. And so I did the thesis, and they were impressed with it. Got my MBA degree, and the Professor Moore, I remember him, who was in advanced accounting, was my advisor, and he was the one that reviewed my thesis work. He said, well, I think this is so good, I'm going to send it to Leonard Poole. So Leonard Poole got this thesis, and along in about the summer of 57, when I got my degree, and I'm now 29 years old, Leonard calls me in the office with Ed Domi. He said, I've been reading your thesis here, Dexter, and how'd you like to go to England and start Air Products in Europe? And so Leonard had the idea that we should also be international as well. And we, in fact, had licensed a small company that's been spun out of the old British coal industry, the Butterley Company, had licensed them to make packaged oxygen plants. And he said, we've been thinking about doing a joint venture and with us becoming the majority owner, and we'd like you to go over and be the managing director, and here's a one-way airplane ticket. You'll have to earn a return trip. So, 29 years old, I'm Donnelly is 6 years older than I am, so he's 35. I'm not going to get around him very quickly. And so how can I continue to grow? How can I continue to develop? And, taking on Union Carbide was interesting, but now here's an opportunity to take on the other three members of the cartel in Europe. And so I talked to Dottie, and Dottie's dad said, well, these opportunities are going to come once, you better take it. And so Dottie was keen, and Ed clearly encouraged it. And so we went abroad, and I asked Leonard, where should the office be? He said, well, you decide. And well, I knew about Wimbledon. That was about the only place I could. I loved tennis, and I was a keen tennis player. And so we decided to live in Wimbledon, and the office was initially downtown, and then finally we got it moved out to the suburbs near Wimbledon. But just by the time the office got built, we got transferred back to the United States. But We went there on a 2-year assignment, and it took me 10 years to complete it. And so we went there from 57 to 67, and we started Air Products in Europe. And that's fun. I mean, to start a company from scratch and to take on three of the leaders in their business, in their own backyard, and to challenge them for customers. I mean, there isn't a greater challenge or opportunity that a young man can have. I mean, today you'd say it was foolhardy, but we did it, and we hired, one person at a time, we got one customer at a time, and our licensee had screwed up two of the designs they were working on, one for the steel industry and one for the chemical, the two biggest markets. One plant that wouldn't work and the other one blew up, and so we didn't even start on the goal line. We were back of the end zone. But the integrity of the people of Air Products. So if we made a mistake, our licensee screwed it up, we didn't supervise them well, we're going to put it right. And Leonard and Ed and that whole team of people said, whatever it takes, whatever it costs, there's only one way of doing things, and that's the right way, and so we're going to put it right. And we did, and they worked fine. And the other thing that taught us is that when you go overseas, you've got to send your best people, because they have to operate independently from head office. There are too many decisions that have to be made on the spot, and you just have to have the confidence that the people that you're sending have what it takes to make the right decisions. To send junior people over there without the experience, and it's a hard thing for companies to do at times, because if they're really good, you need them at home to deal with the big new things you're doing at home, and to send them to a small operation overseas is inconsistent with the demands for their experience. But you'll never succeed unless you send your best, because there's just too many issues. And so I learned it, and I considered, even though I was 29, that I was probably the best marketing guy that Air Products had, and so I wasn't afraid of taking on British Oxygen and then Whatever Creed, and then a German Messer and German Linde in their own backyards.
When you wanted to move to expand into the continent,
I
think you bought out Butterley's then, didn't you?
Yeah, we did. I mean, we had these problems. Butterley was poor people. They didn't understand the problems. All they were doing was signing checks, and you felt sorry for them. And said, well, look, here's a way to, we'll take them out. And again, we were taking the long view. Mm-hmm. And so they couldn't help. They were, in fact, a hindrance, because we had to get their permission, and they were reluctant to put more money into something that, two plants blown up, their reputation, and so if they could get some money back, but it got us started, it got us there. Yeah. But then,
The other thing you had problems with arguing with Home Office was about the power aspects.
Yeah, well, that was...
European power isn't as cheap as American power.
Exactly, yeah. Well, I wrote one really stinging letter, and then Ed also taught me about how to handle that. We were having a difficult time because we relied on the parent company for process engineering, a fundamental process design, not the mechanical execution that was done locally, but the flow sheet and how the flow sheet should be put together and how you balance out various economic factors. Well, the price of electricity in Europe was 2 or 3 times, because they had very high priced coal in Europe, and we had low cost natural gas and cheap coal. And so their electricity was hot, ours were low. So we always balanced on minimizing capital and spending more on less efficient motors and higher pressure drops and running the plants at a higher pressure. Well, when you tried to sell that, the British capital charges were about the same. If anything, they had longer depreciation schedules than we did, so their capital charges were relatively low. But their power costs, their monthly annual operating costs, were high because the cost of energy was high. And so these designs that we were using were really optimized for the U.S. market, not for the European market. And so I was having some difficulty getting our customers to buy into our concept, low capital costs steel and chemical companies were used to optimizing on their consumables and not on their capital so much. So I complained bitterly, and then I wrote a long kind of a stinging letter to Leonard, and I said, look, you sent me over here, you said you'd support me, and you keep sending me these rubbish designs that are non-competitive. And how do you expect me to sell this rubbish if we can't be competitive? And the letter went to Leonard. He was out. I got a call from the chief process engineer one day, and he said, you know, we're working on the design, how can you help? And I said, well, look, you guys are not doing a good job. Go read my letter to Leonard. And bang. So, a couple hours later, Donnelly called me back and said, look, you're absolutely right. But what you got to do is motivate these people to help you. Don't put them on the defensive and make them feel angry at you, because they won't help you. So that was a good lesson. You know, you can vent your spleen, but if you don't motivate the other guy to do what you want, you're not accomplishing your goal. So we got that sorted out. But it was a lesson, because what it said is that you've got to design for the customer. And you've got to understand what the customer's needs are, and you've got to understand well what the competition is doing and responding to those customers' needs. And so it was the presumption that what was right in the United States was also right for Europe. You know, you had to displace that, and that helped us, because ultimately energy became more expensive in the United States too.
Need a drink yet?
No, I'm fine, thank you.
Okay. So, we adjusted clearly and quickly, and started, you know, putting the more capital, more heat transfer surface in, more efficient compressors, paid a little bit more in the capital, but significantly reduced our energy. And today, our designs probably are very much more optimized on what we would call a total return basis, mm-hmm. and recognizing that the customer, you know, has different ways of evaluating capital, and understanding those requirements up front is very critical to optimizing the design for that particular use or application. And in the chemical industry, for instance, they'll write the capital off over 10 years. The steel industry will write it off over 20 years. So capital charges for the steel industry are low, but operating costs is high. Chemical industry, which had been my market, you know, put relatively high capital charges on their assets, because they're looking at technological obsolescence being a much higher factor, and they don't want to take 20 years to recover their capital. So in their cases, and then in most cases, the chemical industry had access to low cost, you know, hydrocarbons, natural gas, waste heat, and so forth, so that their energy charges were normally pretty well optimized. Whereas the steel industry would quite frequently buy, you know, their power and pay, you know, high grid rates for it.
I'm quoting here from out of thin air.
Yeah.
The Home Office had not planned this expansion and at times put roadblocks in its way. Meaning you had started to open up offices?
We wanted to go simultaneously into Germany, Belgium, Holland, France, and Italy, and we had won important contracts in those markets, again sending one good man to that territory to develop business, respond to some of these growth people. And the interesting thing was that you know, you think a monopoly is a tough thing to crack, but quite honestly, customers like to have choices. And so we were relatively well received. I mean, some nationalistic companies didn't want to do business with America. They only wanted to do business with the French or the Germans. But those who were generally interested in having a competitive situation welcomed us, and both in Britain and then on the continent. And we were able to win key contracts that got us established in Belgium and Germany and the Netherlands, and then into France. We acquired a joint venture relationship with Shell in France and go after that market. But because I got all of these things going simultaneously, and because some of these things took upfront capital to start a new company, and because we believe strongly in the concept of owning the plant and selling the gas, keep the cow, sell the milk, there was a lot of upfront capital, and we had no revenue coming in as we started separate companies, and you couldn't, you know, consolidate one against the other, so you couldn't match cash flows. Each one had a joint venture partner that we had developed, and Ed simultaneously had the view in the United States that we ought to begin to take our technology skills and apply them to the chemical industry. And so he started the chemical business. First the ammonia plant, and then the acquisition of Fujri, and then the acquisition of Escambia Chemical, and then Erco Chemicals, and so he's trying to push the chemical business forward, and he's got some good deals. And I'm over there in Europe trying to make acquisitions to accelerate our growth in the gas business, and we run out of money. And one I had a wonderful joint venture deal in Italy with the second largest company in the north of Italy, which would have put us on the ground floor in Italy, and I'd been selling oxygen plants in Italy from London and winning important orders there. Now what we want to do is become a gas company and not just a hardware company. We want to